I took my water tablet earlier, so I won't need to pee.
How's the prostate doing? All right.
You're the fucking doctor.
Oh yeah, you're a doctor, aren't you? Oh sorry. I digress.
Yeah. We'll do a mini clinic afterwards, all right.
Hi, I'm Raz Shaw, and I'm a theatre director and lately a bit of a writer. And I've been very close to it three times.
And I'm Hannah Harris, and I'm a doctor, and sadly, I see a lot of it in my job.
In this podcast, we're going to be talking about the elephant in all our rooms.
Death.
Each week, we're going to be speaking to guests we admire and asking them, amongst other things, to curate their own memorial service.
In order to peel back the layers of their life so far.
So I went for some tests, and long and the short of it is a week later, I had a triple heart bypass. And I was only 47.
What they do or don't hold dear.
Wistfulness and nostalgia and thinking what might be are all part of something that is just your imagination. They're not what really is.
Their take on their own mortality.
And how they want to be remembered at the end of their lives.
I suppose how he could be remembered, he was a lucky bastard. That kind of thing would be pretty good.
A kind of desert island death, if you like.
Oh, that's good. So, welcome to our brand spanking new podcast, Death and the Elephant.
Our guest today is actor Terence Frisch. Terry has worked on TV, in the West End, and in theatres all over the UK and beyond.
And beyond. He's been in the business, amazingly, for well over 30 years.
That is a very long time. And you've worked with him a lot, haven't you, Raz?
I have indeed, Hannah. I have indeed. I've worked with him loads of times, mainly because he's a great actor, a top bloke, an amazing company member. And he also happens to be the most dapper man in the whole of showbiz. Now, we spoke to him a few weeks ago and we had a lovely time, didn't we, Hannah?
We really did. He's a total charmer. And the thing that interested me about him most, apart from the fact that he's probably one of the most humble people I've ever met, is when he was talking about being an actor, he really talked about it as a job rather than being his whole life.
I know. Really refreshing. So, without further ado, Dr. Hannah, can we have a listen?
Oh, yes, we can.
Let's go.
So, Terry, thank you so much for coming on our podcast.
Oh, that's all right.
I've seen your never-ending CV, and it looks like you've worked everywhere and in everything, from the West End to every corner of the UK and beyond. And obviously in the last pandemic year, you've been forced to stay at home for the whole year. So has that been weird for you? What have you done to cope and what have you been up to?
Oh, that's weird. Yeah, I've had to stay at home, which has been really nice. I like being home.
Has it?
Yeah. When people say, what's your lockdown like? And people say, oh, you know, it's been difficult, been out of work and all this kind of stuff. It sounds terrible, doesn't it? But I've quite enjoyed it. It's just kind of, I don't know, just getting to spend time at home doing things you want to do at home, like the garden. I spent nearly all the time in the garden, especially the early part of last year.
Oh, what kind of gardening do you do? I've become a bit of a lockdown gardener.
Oh, have you?
Oh, here we go. Right.
Yeah.
I've been gardening since I was a kid. My mum was a big gardener. And so I got quite a kind of established garden. So I've just been keeping up with all the things that when you've got an established garden, you've got to do anyway, but you kind of forget because you're away on tour for a couple of months.
Must have been really nice to actually properly have time to do it how you want to do it.
Don't ask me about my garden because...
Oh, you've got a garden that somebody did for you, haven't you?
This is true. Don't out me as a middle-class so-and-so.
Sorry.
But that is also true. But
nice one, Terry.
Well, let's address the first of hopefully many elephants in the room. And we hence the title. See what we did there. And so when we asked you to come on a podcast, you were at first somewhat reluctant. I think that's fair to say, right?
Yeah, at first I said, yeah, great. And then I thought about it. And that's when I thought, oh, hang on a minute. Do I want to kind of reveal things about myself? I always have this thing, right, about people. You meet somebody, maybe for the first time, like, say, I meet you, Hannah, or whatever.
Yeah.
And we chat away, and the conversation goes on a tangent, and we get really involved about something. And you say things that afterwards you think, actually, no, I didn't really mean that, or not, nothing particularly of any great shakes. But it gives that person a colour of you, doesn't it?
Mm.
Like, there was an actor recently who passed away, and people were saying good things about them and all this kind of stuff. And I'd met them once, and only for a few hours. I'd spent some time in a tent with them on a film set, and I thought they were so rude and yeah, really, really rude. And yet everybody in this thing said how wonderful they were and listed all the things they'd done. And I thought, you know, I just got that person on a bad day. I got this person, you know, in a situation where they probably would have thought, oh God, I was a right arse today. And I kind of, that's what I always kind of concerns me about, that whole thing of people saying things they then know about you. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And they kind of think that's what you're like.
Yeah, yeah. I totally get that.
Whatever way that is, you know, whatever that could be.
I have a theory, though, which I think is similar to that, is that acting, whilst you know, you are a brilliant actor and you clearly love acting. Acting is not necessarily everything you are. It's, in some sense, it's the job that you do, but doesn't define who you are.
That's it. That is it.
And
that's
so
it's my job.
It's your job. And so in an interview like this, when we're asking to talk, you're used to talking about Terry the actor, and if you're in a show or whatever, talking about that. But asking to talk to Terry the person,
that's
above
exactly
and beyond the actor,
it
makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. I'm suddenly the person at the bus stop then. I'm suddenly like, oh, excuse me, madam, can we ask you about the blah, 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 blah? And, oh, I don't know. It's nothing to do with me, you know. Oh, I was talking to that man at the bus stop earlier on today. He was an horrible man. I'd need to burn him or something, you know what I mean? And that's what they're really thinking. But they wouldn't dare say that in front of the camera because that's not nice. That's not polite. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm.
You know, acting is just my job. I only became an actor because I didn't like my job. I didn't know what I wanted to do, really, when I left school. I was going to join the Navy for years, the Royal Navy, and then I changed my mind about 6 months before I left school. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I ended up in the building trade, in builder's merchant, and then in a building company. And it was just so wrong, the wrong business for me. I wasn't good at what I was doing, really. I was sitting in an office being a buyer for a little building company, hating it, trying to get out of every bit I did of it, bored as hell. And I thought, what do I like doing that I could make a living at, right? I thought, oh, no, I'll be an actor. How'd you be an actor? I like doing that. And I was in a really small time drama group up at the local, kind of attached to the local church, in the school hall, once a week, and we did pantos at Christmas and an Akebourne farce in the summer. And we rehearsed once a week over God knows how long and put on a play with cardboard sets and bits of furniture nicked from your mum's and all that kind of stuff. It was
brilliant.
Everybody came and said, it's always brilliant, you're ever so good and all this kind of stuff. But it was probably, you know, pretty ropey. So anyway, I thought, oh, I wonder how you'd be an actor. So at lunchtime, I went down the careers office. And I said, you know, how do I be an actor? And he said, I don't know. And I said, have you got anything about learning to be an actor? And he said, well, there's some the drama school stuff over there in that box. And it was quite literally a cut-out corner thing of a cornflake box, like making a filing thing, yeah? On a dusty thing at the back of this file. And I got it out, and there were drama school prospectus. Now, I'd never even heard of a drama school.
No way. That's amazing.
I was 21, 2. So I got these things, and I thought, Rod, oh, that one's Royal. I'll go there. I'll go to that one. So I realised you had to audition. So I auditioned and I got a recall at RADA. And I thought, wow. I'm going RADA. Brilliant. And I hadn't told anybody about it at all. Not even my girlfriend, not my mum, not anyone. And then I didn't get in. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, what do you mean? They don't want me. I didn't realise there were like millions of people trying to get into drama school.
Yeah, it's a massively competitive industry.
I didn't know that. So I tried two more. And one of them didn't even get an audition. No, one of them, I did get an audition. They didn't want to know me. The other one auditioned me and were kind of indicated by the end of the audition that I was on a good thing. And on the Monday morning, rang me up and said, can you have a place? Do you want a place?
Yay!
So I went to drama school. And I then had to tell everybody, I'm going to drama school. I'm giving up work. And everybody kind of went, what? Yeah, hey, hang on a minute. Drama school? What's that? And I didn't really know what it was going to be like. So I give up work, handed in my notice, saved all the money I could for a couple of months, got a grant off the local authority, which was really lucky. That year it was me and a ballet dancer, apparently. I remember thinking, I'm finding out. And I went to drama school. And the first day I got there, I thought, this is brilliant. We're just farting about and playing games all day with all these odd people from all over the country.
And nothing has changed.
You know, apart from summer camp with the scouts, I'd never been further north than Birmingham, you know.
Nothing has changed in 30 years.
Best job in the world.
And it was brilliant. I just thought, oh, look at them. They talk funny. Look at that person. They're Scottish. Oh, God. Yeah, it was just a laugh. And I thought, what fun. This is great. It's like playing games for the rest of your life. So anyway, I went to drama school and I was lucky to get a job just before I left. And then I just kind of jobbed doing it. But it is a job.
So I guess from the outset, from that lunch hour when you went to the careers office and had a look at what job you wanted to do and what it would be like to be an actor, that's where it all started, is sort of looking at it as a job.
Yeah, if they'd have been on their lunch break or something, I wouldn't have found that cornflakes box with those drama school perspectives.
You don't think, if that hadn't happened, this whole thing would have passed you by?
Yeah, I think so, probably. I probably, thinking of where I was and when I was at that time in my life, I would have probably got married to who I was with at the time, settled down, and carried on, I suppose. I don't know. It didn't happen, so I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, well, thankfully.
Who knows?
This kind of ties into one of our elephant questions, which is about the kind of forks in the road and sliding doors moments. And it sounds like that was a major one for you, that fork in the road.
Yeah. But you know, like people, when you say things like that, they say, God, that's terribly brave. I remember at the time people saying to me, God, you're terribly brave going into such an insecure occupation. And I thought, it didn't seem very brave to me. It was just like what happened.
Yeah.
I just thought this and did that and that happened and then this happened and then I went there.
It's great. You kind of didn't realise how brave it was at the time, which is probably the best way for it to be.
Yeah. Is that called stupidity though, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know.
No, not at all.
I mean, it didn't feel very brave is all I mean.
Have there been any other forks in the road or sliding doors moments like that in your life, do you think, where you wondered kind of what might have been?
I do that all the time. I wonder what might have been about lots of things.
Do you?
I'm quite wistful about things. Yeah. But you just do, don't you?
In a kind of melancholic way or?
I don't know. Is wistfulness not always slightly melancholic? Isn't by its very definition it slightly melancholic?
Yeah, I would say so. Looking back and reflecting.
I think it's a slightly joyful melancholia. Yeah, joyful melancholia.
I like it.
Is that possible?
That's good.
You know, like past loves in a way, that kind of thing.
I wouldn't know about that.
When you think about people, I'm glad I'm not with that so-and-so again, but that we had a lovely time. Oh, it was so nice. That day was, it's that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great example of joyful melancholia.
Yeah, although I have a thing, and maybe that because I am, you know, a grumpy old bastard. But I have a thing where, you know, there's a part of me, and it's in my book, Death and the Elephant, all good bookshops.
You're in a book?
I mean, you wouldn't know it. Nostalgia is a bit of a dirty word, because nostalgia takes you down a path of yesterday and takes you away from the moment you're in now. And I've definitely been, certainly in relationships, where it's not that they've been yearning for somebody else. They've been yearning for a time that was, you know, in rose-tinted glasses, better than this one. And it often doesn't feel like you're living in the present then. And that feels, that just feels a shame.
I think that's a bit of a negative view of nostalgia. I think of nostalgia as a really lovely, warm thing, a bit like Terry was saying, where you get the chance to reflect on the things that happened and how nice they were. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not enjoying the present. You're just enjoying the past as well.
It clearly reflects badly on the dark soul that I have and the dark soul that I am. Anyhow,
I think that this interesting here, you talked about forks in the road, right, kind of thing. This isn't maybe a sliding door, but I was once very early one morning, or a very late one night, in fact, sitting on a beach with someone and just sort of mulling all these kind of things with someone, and realised that the only thing that exists, I know this sounds stupid, but the only thing that exists is now. Wistfulness and nostalgia and planning and thinking what might be are all part of something that is just your imagination. They're not what really is. And I remember at that moment in time thinking, right, from now on, I'm only going to live now. This is it. And that's very me anyway, because I think the whole point is I don't ever plan anything. I never, when I start doing something, I've never thought what it's going to be like at the end. I've just started. So I've no idea where we're going to end up.
See what happens.
It's interesting, because that leads me inexorably onto my next question. Because we've known each other for about 20 years, I'd say. Is that right?
Oh, 22.
That is a long time. How did you guys meet?
We met, you were helping Ed Goggin cast Charlie Sexboots.
Oh, yes.
Charlie Sexboots is a brilliant piece of theatre. And Raz helped cast it, I think. And that's when you first bumped into me.
I knew you'd remember. And then I cast him in a great play that I was telling you about, Hannah, called Belly. And
I played Mini Trev, didn't I?
Mini Trev, the ex-soldier.
Why was he called Mini Trev?
Because I was small. It's meant to be a big bloke who's a soldier, and they ended up with me.
Right. No, well, this says a lot for Terry, because when we first were looking, we were looking for a big, hunky, 6'2" ex-soldier, and the thing is that when Terry came in, that's the thing about auditions. You have to be open for the person that you're not expecting to come in and blow you away. And Terry came in and he blew us away. And therefore, the expectation we had that this soldier, that every soldier would be 6'2", that every hunky gay man would be a hunky 6'2" gay man, it was just complete bullshit and blown away by Terry coming in and auditioning. And that is true. And so he became known to us all as Mini Trev.
And acting like a 6'2" muscle man.
Exactly. Act like you're 6'2", darling. But no, and one of the things, as you've just been talked about, when you're in rehearsals, you're very much someone who's totally in the now, who's totally in the moment, and live each moment of rehearsals. Your enthusiasm, your curiosity is inspiring. And so we often ask people on here about what they consider their achievements are to date and what they've got left to achieve. And I want to ask you that question, but with the caveat that I know that you are, as you've said, a truly now person. So maybe you see life in a different way and you don't necessarily see life as the things you've achieved and the things you want to achieve, or maybe you do. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, which is why I'm asking you the question.
Do you have anything to add, Hannah, before I do a monologue again?
No. No, let's go straight into the monologue.
Okay, so when you asked me about this, and you sort of, you know, give me gist of what might, you know, the sort of thing that might come up, I thought about that. And the truth is that I'm not really ambitious. When people say to me, what do you want out of life, or what do you want professionally, I haven't got a clue. I just kind of think, oh, I didn't learn that bit. Hang on a minute. Sorry. So can you say that again? What do you mean? I don't actually know what that means. I mean, yes, of course, I look at people who I was, say, at school with or whatever, and I think, my God, they're really successful. But I don't really equate that to me. I'm very lucky. I get to live in a nice house with a lovely garden, and I've got nice friends and a good life, a relaxed life without too many pressures. Now, okay, money's, you know, not free-flowing all the time, but I'm not bad. I don't need a lot. Rent's quite cheap. As long as I can buy a pint of beer and, you know, pay the rent and feed myself, then what does it matter? I live in a country that's luckily pretty free. I can do what I like. I can be who I want to be. I've travelled if I want. You know, I have travelled. I spent 6 months in Spain, you know, part of last year, doing off and on, staying in lovely places and that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. What does anybody want to achieve? Do you? When people say, oh, like so-and-so, oh, yeah, they're a regular at the National, I think, oh, that would be nice. But I don't think that's what I'm going to get. I've got to achieve that, because the chances are that's really unlikely, you know. So not because of that, but just because I don't think of it that way.
That's sort of what I expected you to say. And I think that's really a powerful and positive way of looking at life. There are things that you would be happy to do. It doesn't feel like it eats you away inside that you're not, that you might not be doing those things, or it eats you away inside that you need to be doing something by this time. I mean, a lot of people have a clock that's ticking. They feel the clock of their life ticking, but it doesn't feel like you do.
I suppose I do feel the clock ticking a bit sometimes. I'm 56, and you often talk about the three, is it three times you've said that you nearly died?
Yes.
You know, which is really quite funny. And I've sort of thought about myself, and I thought, well, I don't have any of those. But about a few years ago, about eight years ago, I didn't feel very well. I was lucky enough to be working in Barbados doing a dinner show, and I was running around like a blue-ass fly. And come off stage, and I was sitting down and thinking, God, I can hardly breathe. This is really difficult. It's half hot, isn't it? Can I have a glass of water, you know, and then going back on stage and running around for another 10 minutes, and then coming back off and feeling, God, I don't seem to be able to get any breath. Anyway, I came back from this, and I had one night when I went out on the drink a bit heavy, and felt awful for about 3 days. And that wasn't usual. And then I went to my doctor's, and she said, well, let's send you for some tests. So I went for some tests, and long and the short of it is, a week later, I had a triple heart bypass. And I was only 47, and I thought, oh, you know, that's a bit of a wake-up call.
Gosh, no wonder you weren't feeling very well.
No, exactly. I should have, since I got better, I should have run a marathon and dedicated my life to Zen Buddhism, but I haven't really. I kind of thought, oh, well, you know, that was a lucky. I do eat better than I did. Not that I eat badly anyway. I didn't eat badly. I suffer from hypercholesterolemia. Which they told me is probably a familial thing. And my dad died at 47 with a heart attack. And funnily enough, I was 47 when I had this episode. Exactly. Probably almost around exactly the same age he was. On the morning of the operation, I was staying in the hospital. Where was I? Hammersmith Hospital, near the Scrubs. And I had to get up, and I was in this little room on my own, and I had to, they came and they woke me up and said, right, you need to get washed and shaved now. So I got out of bed, and I went to this massive bathroom all on my own. You know, they have these enormous bathrooms that you could swing
a
bag of cats around. And and I had to shave myself from chest to feet, the front of my body. And I'm quite a hairy bloke, like quite hirsute. And when I'd finished, I stood there with this full-length mirror looking at myself. And I looked like a little round man.
A big baby.
A little blob. I looked like a baby. I looked like an overgrown baby. Remember that Vic and Bob? He's a baby. He's a baby. It was like that. I looked dreadful. And I didn't have much hair, and I don't have much hair now. And I just thought, oh, my God. And I stood there and I thought, this is going to be the last thing I see before I pop my gloves. And I did think, I got on the trolley thing and went downstairs almost straight after, and they said, okay, they'll come out and get you in a second. And they went off, and for about 10 minutes I was just lying there looking under the bedclothes at my little sad body with, you know, my little private parts looking like the day that I was born. I did feel a bit sad all of a sudden. I was kind of overwhelmed with, right, this could be it, blimey, you know. And I just thought, oh well, you know, if this is it, this is it, you know, because you've signed one of those things that said, if I die, it's not your fault.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck, isn't it not? It is your fault. You just killed me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I did think, shit, this is a bit close to the bone here.
And when you didn't die.
I know. Amazing. Medical science.
But did you feel like going forward, did you feel like, oh, did it change anything going forward?
Well,
in terms of, you know, I've got to get things done.
Thing is waking up with this bloody great tube down your throat and going, I can't think about it because I'll gag and I mustn't gag. And I started to panic. And I could feel this panic coming up in my tummy while I was lying there with this thing down my throat, thinking, just don't think about
it. Oh, it's so horrible, isn't it?
It was awful. And eventually they took it out, and I was just, oh, I don't care now. That's great.
One of the things I often talk about being close to death is my lack of feeling bothered about it in the moment. In the moment, there are other things to do. In the moment, I need to, you know, make that doctor laugh, or I need all that kind of stuff. And I'm not thinking about I'm going to die. In some moments in the middle of the night, I talk about it in my book, sometimes in the middle of the night, I would wake up, and especially when I was in critical in a hospital, and go, what the fuck am I doing here? And have a moment.
Yeah,
just a little moment, but it's not a long moment. It's not a moment of fear. It's a moment of
like me sitting outside the operating theatre,
like Terry's baby moment in the bathroom.
They're quite occasional. I think they're much more is what you're talking about. Is that you're thinking about? Oh, I wonder if I'll get a chance of having another cup of tea there.
Exactly. Exactly.
Do you think? Hang on, if I make them laugh, you might get a cup of tea. And you're thinking about that rather than the serious stuff that's really going on. You know?
I suppose it's a way of distracting yourself, isn't it?
Exactly.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is.
You're not letting yourself think about it. And in the moments where it really does sort of, it's confronting, you do feel quite scared.
I think it is a distraction technique, but it's also because I would often think, and a therapist would say this, is like my desperation to make people laugh or show somebody that I can find the comedy in something serious is partly to do with that genuine desperation to feel in the height of something difficult, like you think you might die, to feel yourself, to feel like you're you and you can be yourself, which is which is for me, that's not taking life seriously. So in the most serious of moments, I don't want to be seen to be taking this serious moment too seriously.
No, because if anything, and I suppose, I don't know whether this is, it's something that's often spoken about, I don't know, it's kind of slightly old-fashioned or I don't know, more of a, stiff upper lip sort of thing. But I don't know, it's not quite the right word. But what I mean to say is that, could be worse. Mustn't grumble. And there's an element, I think, in most people about like that, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, that
definitely.
We will have a grumble, but not really about anything serious. Nothing that really bothers you. If something's really going to bother you, you make light of it because that way it can't get the better of you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not going to get one over on me. Even death, even the thing that'll turn all the lights off, that's not going to get one over on my sense of humour.
Yeah.
To be able to laugh at the ridiculous nature of the situation that we, who are just basically apes, have got ourselves in. It's ridiculous. You know, you think about it, it's a complete joke. Humour is what makes you human more than anything.
You weren't after you shaved your whole body.
No. If I really was serious about it, I wouldn't recount that story, would I? I'd recount the story because I know it's amusing.
He was a baby ape.
Yeah, it's a baby ape. I was sleeping in an apricot.
So your relationship with death is quite a sort of positive one. So even how old were you when your dad died? So even when your dad died,
8,
you dealt with it and moved on.
They dwelt on my dad not having a dad more when I got older in my late 20s, when I suddenly thought a mate of mine was saying, oh, I'm going out for a drink with dad tonight, and I'd think, oh, that must be great to go out for a drink with somebody of a completely different generation but who knows you so well. So when like dad died on a Saturday morning while I was watching Tarzan on the telly, and later in the afternoon, I went down the off licence with one of my sisters and my brother. We went down the alleyway just at the end of the road, and this mate of theirs was sitting on the bench, and he went, oh, look at you lot. You know, I look miserable as somebody died. And I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. My brother and sister kind of went, oh, yeah, our dad's just died. And I was thinking, that's really funny because dad's just died. I remember thinking it was funny because it was funny. It is funny. It's made you laugh.
That's so sweet. That says a lot about you and your sense of humour, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, a couple of years later when it was just me and mum, I would call out at night and shout out, mum, mum, mum. And she'd come to the bottom of the stairs and said, what? And I'd say, oh, just checking.
Aww.
That was it, you know. And I imagine I was probably a little bit worried that she might go as well.
Yeah.
But I don't ever remember really getting upset about it. I remember having a cry a little while later, a few months later or a month later or so, when we were watching Benny Hill on the telly. My dad loved Benny Hill, thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And Benny Hill was on, and I remember crying because dad wasn't there to watch it.
I suppose as a child, you're not really aware of things being finite and endings being absolute. I think probably age 6, you don't have that, or 7, you don't have that understanding. No. So I guess maybe that's why you didn't have the sadness immediately, but it sort of, you had the realization as time went on.
Is it to do as a child? Everything's always changing. Mm. Everything's always new. Yeah. That's why time goes quicker when we're older, because we've seen everything, or a lot of things. It's when we like to experience things, I think, sometimes, because it means that life's more varied. When it's mundane, like lockdown or whatever, I think people feel the passage of time a lot quicker because it's just the same. I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. Whereas something new, like a journey going somewhere, is always much more interesting and takes longer than the journey coming back because you've seen it all, you know? And it's the same with kids.
Yeah, that's so true. I was having this very conversation with my mum the other day about how supposedly about how the passage of time and how you experience it. And when you're having new experiences, like children are having all the time, then it makes it feel like time's passing really slowly because you're laying down new memories. And when you're an adult and you've kind of seen lots of things before and it's all familiar and you're not creating memories because they're already there, then time passes a lot more quickly.
That's why you become jaded, isn't it? It's like that character that used to be in the Fast show. Do you remember? There's the sky. Isn't it brilliant? Look, it's above you and it's blue. Wow, it's amazing. And an adult, that's a child, isn't it?
Yeah.
And an adult's going, yeah, well, of course it's up there. It's always up there. I've seen it up there so many times.
It's always blue, yeah.
Every podcast I feel slightly, I feel like a child in the presence of gurus every time. And this is,
I don't know, but
this is another time. The guru, the guru Hannah and the guru Frish are beyond, above and around me. And I am grateful for their presence.
Yeah, I will expect bows from you every time we meet now, Raz. Okay.
What would you say to your 18-year-old self if you had the chance?
What would I say to my 18-year-old self?
Yeah.
All right. The Grand National winner in 1992. It's a real outsider. Put 100 pence on the nose. I don't know. I honestly don't know, really. Don't get worried. Don't worry about things. Things just sort of have a way of, well, as I say, I feel terribly lucky in my life. I was born into a very loving family. I get on great with all my brothers and sisters. And my mum, you know, star, top woman, who you met a few times.
I did. She came to my 40th birthday party.
Which was one of the funniest days ever. Hysterical. When somebody fired a gun over a hedge and everybody was looking for this.
What happened?
I was looking after my mum for a few years, right? My mum was a wonderful lady, very shy, a widow sort of from her mid-40s or early 40s, brought me up, basically. And then I happened to move back to the family home, and mum got dementia, basically, long and short, and Parkinson's, and was confined to a wheelchair. And I used to look after her. And Raz said, come to my 40th birthday. It's in Regent's Park. And I said, well, yeah, I'll have to bring my mum, though, because I can't leave her home all day. So he said, yeah, right. So I got on the train with my mum and the wheelchair. And we wheeled across Regent's Park. And there we were. And we were having a lovely, fun time. And then at one point, there was this almighty, beautiful sunny day, wasn't it? There was this almighty bang, like a gunshot. And everybody looked around. I thought, oh, my God, what's that? And we looked over the hedge. Has somebody been shot or something? And everyone's going, what was that noise? Anyway, I looked around and I noticed my mum is giggling. And my mum didn't really talk. She'd lost the power of speech at this point. But she was laughing. And her shoulders were going like this. And she was really crying with laughter. And I went over to her and I noticed that one of her tyres on her wheelchair, it exploded in the sun. I'd pumped it up too much, and it had blown up. And that was the shot. Everybody thought it was somebody shooting someone. It was my mum on her wheelchair laughing like this.
Brilliant.
It was very fun. Anyway, that
was my daring picture of Terry leaving my 40th birthday with him wheeling the three-wheel wheelchair. He was sort of like limping along.
But my mum's laughing all the way to Baker Street Station.
That is so sweet.
Yeah, that was funny. So in a way, mum, you know, Parkinson's and severe dementia, and still found it funny that everybody else was looking for this shooting somebody. So I had a good relationship with her. Sorry, I digressed badly, or very well.
Yeah, beautifully, in fact.
What were we talking
How
about?
How you want to be remembered.
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, so I've been very lucky. So... I suppose how he could be remembered. He was a lucky bastard. That kind of thing would be pretty good.
Which is probably true.
yeah. No, I've never really thought about death much. I was brought up a Roman Catholic in a family of non-church-going Roman Catholics. But I sort of grew up thinking of heaven and hell. But kind of, I think you just get turned off, don't you? You know, you go back to going into the earth again. Your atoms, all just atoms at the end of the day.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Kind of, yeah. Mm. You know, the clues. That's a pretty big clue, isn't it? In the Bible.
Yeah.
Well, the good thing about you dying, right? The good thing about you dying.
I don't have to listen to it anymore.
I'm not just saying you, Terry. I'm saying. Don't hear this shit anymore. No, no. But the good thing is that if you choose, you can get a you can have a memorial service. You can hope all the people that you know. Of all parts of your life, whether you've wronged them or whether they were great friends, they can all gather and they can all, you know, celebrate the life of Terence Frisch. Now,
yeah, this is your chance.
This is your chance. So how would that memorial service feel? What would it be like?
Well, it'd be two things. It'd be really, really, really happy and really, really, really sad. Be both. Because at every funeral I've ever gone, I've gone, oh, God, yeah, do you remember that? Oh, wasn't that lovely about that person? You never knew that about them. I think it's really sad at the end of a funeral. Somebody stands up and reads an epigram, an epitaph, a eulogy, whatever it's called, one of those things. And they speak about this person and they tell. I've done a few for other people. So I did one for a friend of mine's mum. The number of people that come up to me afterwards and said, God, I didn't know that about her. I knew this, but I didn't know that. Isn't that amazing? I wish I'd known more about that. And you kind of find out lots of things from other people at funerals. So it would be really interesting, I think, to hear what all those different people said. Because some people who know you one way really, really well don't know you at all another way. My 50th birthday party a few years ago now, I had loads of different people from all different walks of life. People I'd been to school with, people I was at drama school with, some Morris dancers I'd done Morris dancing with, and all different weird stuff. Actors. So a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, did a brilliant quiz about me, a pub quiz based on me. And my sisters came third because there's so much they don't know about me. I think what would be nice would just be you want people to get up and say what they think of you, not what you think of you. And then you find everybody thinks you're a complete twat.
Yeah, it's a shame, really, that you don't get to do a practice run so that you can hear all these things.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, all these people saying things about you. Hopefully they're nice things, but they get to. Raz, have you fallen asleep or are you frozen?
No, but I was just thinking, in terms of readings or songs or anything else that would make us think of you, have you thought of stuff that...
He Who Would Valiant Be.
Oh, that's a great hymn.
Great hymn, and I have it with a big choir. Gainst all disaster. I love that song. I love it. Yeah, that'd be good, wouldn't it?
Okay, we'll definitely pop that one in for you.
Yeah, I really like proper traditional hymns. Would be really good.
So this would be at your memorial service as well as your funeral.
Well, great thing. See, this is one good thing about being a Roman Catholic. You get a proper funeral service up at the church, and then they all go down the Kremlin as well afterwards. So you get another one there.
Oh.
Wow, double bubble.
And then you can have a bit of pop music down there.
What pop music would you have?
What I'd probably have would be something like Move On Up by Curtis Mayfield.
Oh.
Because that would be quite apt when they Move On Up.
It's a great song as well.
Yeah, it is.
What else will be in there?
And then I'd have a disco afterwards. I'd have a disco afterwards, right, or a big dance. And I'd have my top 200 tunes would play right across the board from the Beatles and the Kinks, Small Faces, to lots of old soul, Otis Redding, and I don't know, and a bit of Michael Nyman and some hymns.
It's the Terry's Dead medley.
Yeah, and it'd be really mixed.
Brilliant. And you could pre-record the mix if you're a DJ. You could pre-record it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I could even have a voiceover of the instruction of you're going to dance to this one. No, sit and listen to this one. Yeah, like that kind of thing.
Give instructions.
200 songs is quite long.
It's a bloody long wake.
Well, no, that'd last an evening, wouldn't it? It lasts an evening.
Look, if you tell us we have to do it, we'll do it.
Okay. You might not even be there.
I'll be there. Even if I'm not there, I'll be there. And what about readings or anything like that?
Readings? Oh, God.
Yeah, like, you know.
No, people could choose the things that they think, you know, reflect me.
What do you think someone else would read for you? What do you think someone else would choose?
What's that poem? I'll tell you, I know there's one poem that I would like. Oh, they'd probably do something like If or something by Kipling or something like that. Because that's kind of my spirit, isn't it? It's like get up and do it and don't hang about, isn't it? Just do stuff. Don't sit there wallowing in your own, up your own bum. Just go and do things kind of thing.
Is that your epitaph? Don't go wallowing in your own bum. Here lies Terry Frisch.
Stop wiggling up your own bum.
He never wallowed in his bum.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, funny. See, this is funny. My favourite occupation in life has always been staring, just to have a good stare. You know when you kind of get lost in thought and you just, well, it's not lost in thought even. I don't know actually what you're doing, but you're just staring. I've loved doing that ever since I was a kid. Just having a stare.
That's why you're an actor. You're a daydreamer.
So, yeah, and I don't actually know what you're thinking about.
The funny thing about that is that when I was in Critical in last January, I realised I don't give myself or anyone else in my life silence. I'm with someone, silence doesn't exist because it's all this garbage coming out of my mouth. But I literally, if I'm moving into the bedroom, I turn on the radio. If I move. So when I was in Critical, realised that one of the things I enjoyed doing, I would just sit there and realise I was literally just sitting and looking and thinking, and I don't do that. And it felt like a sort of an extraordinary privilege.
That's what it is. It's just being.
Yeah, exactly. And
You know, I tell you, there is one poem, I think, and it's just occurred to me. J.D. Davies or something, I think his name was. He was one of those people who used to walk through the countryside during the 20s and 30s, I think, and he would just write poems and sell them. And he wrote that poem that goes, what is this world if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare, stand beneath the trees and boughs and be as
I am. To stand beneath the boughs.
That's it. You know that one? Such a nice thing just to stare out a window, into nothingness or into a fire. It's that feeling like when you're looking in a fire. That's what it's like. You know, when you look at flames or rain and you lose yourself in there and you just kind of go into down a tunnel of, I don't know what it is. And people say, what's up? And you go, oh, nothing.
It's almost like
anyway,
being in a trance.
And you're back to reality. It's like being in a trance. Yeah, yeah. So I love that space. So I don't know what that's about. Maybe that's what death's like.
That's Terry's death.
I'll tell you, I know there's one track I would like. There's a record called Leaving Rome by Jojo Bennett. And whenever I play that record to anybody, it's well known in my family, my brothers and sisters are big reggae fans. Whenever I've played it, people go, what's that record? I love that. It's brilliant. It's called Leaving Rome. And that would be a really good one to have because it's a lovely, soft bit of old reggae.
Leaving Rome.
We can make that happen for you.
Yeah, it's brilliant. You listen to it. You'll fall in love with it. It's a lovely
bit.
And you never, ever hear it played anywhere. Wasn't there in the charts or anything? Oh, it's lovely. It's pretty.
I'm going to play it now. I'm playing it now. Ready?
You might not be allowed to. Oh.
You've got it.
Woohoo! Terry's dead. He's dead. Terry's dead. He's leaving us.
Yeah, there you go. It's good, isn't it?
Leisure by W.H. Davies. What is this life if, full of care, we have no time to stand and stare? No time to stand beneath the boughs and stare as long as sheep or cows? No time to see when woods we pass, where squirrels hide their nuts in grass. No time to see in broad daylight, streams full of stars like skies at night. No time to turn at beauty's glance and watch her feet, how they can dance. No time to wait till her mouth can enrich that smile her eyes began. A poor life this, if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Death and the Elephant, an Elephant production, edited by Harry Winteringham, music composed by Mark Melville, and featuring Dr. Han Harris and me, Raz Shaw. Leisure was written by W.H. Davis and read by Terence Frisch. He Who Would Valiant Be was composed by Rafe Vaughan Williams.